I'm going to call the Joint Interim Committee on Justice System Revenues Committee, the first meeting on October the 2nd, 2009, to order. Welcome, everybody. Very happy to see those of you here. We have a job ahead of us. It's going to be a challenging job, and I am very, very happy to have such a wonderful group of people here at the dais on this joint committee. And we are joined today by Christopher Kent from the representing the Oregon Bar, and Douglas Bray, who is the Supreme Court designee, and I welcome all of them to the dais as well. I hope that at the end of the day, that we will feel that we have perhaps reorganized, that we have set in motion a plan and a way that we can never again go through the kind of challenges that we went through in 2009. It is not fair to our constituents and the people of Oregon. It is not fair to the justice system itself, nor to those very dedicated people who work within that system, not to have things more stable and to be where we can perform and be a role model for the rest of the nation in the way we handle our justice system, both for those who deserve to be within it for a long time and those who deserve to just pass through it. So having said that, I will entertain a motion for the adoption of the committee rules, which is the first thing on our agenda today.
Madam Co-Chair, I would move to adopt the committee rules as presented to us.
As way of discussion, the only change in the committee rules will be that it refers to a co-chairs rather than chairs. So any objections, any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Would anyone at the dais now like to make comments? Representative Nathanson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm very pleased to join you on this group. And indeed, all of the members of the group. It's a small group, and we'll be able to work hard and quickly together. I'm going to wait to reserve other comments for discussion of the charter or what our mission is, but I did want to note that when I co-chaired with Senator Walker, a very quick-moving committee during this past legislative session, it was almost breathtaking, the speed with which we discussed a number of options that were related to the justice system fee structure. We weren't looking at quite such a broad scope of responsibility as we are in this group, but nevertheless, it gave us that first chance to look at a number of issues related to the collection of fees, as well as the amount and type of fees there were. It was not only very interesting to me, but I could see that we were ready for more work in this area. And so I guess this is a way of saying that I want to acknowledge the work of the people who were at the table then. It was done very quickly, and I think done well under the circumstances. And in a way, this builds off of those discussions. It doesn't mean it's a continuation of that discussion, but the information gathered for that and some of the work then set the foundation for how we are going to discuss our work today. And for everyone who participated in that previous discussion, I want to say thank you and stay tuned. This is going to be an enjoyable and productive session.
Senator Whitfield.
Thank you, Chair Berger. I think that the judicial system is a critical part of our society, and it is it's something that should be paid for with taxes and general fund, quite frankly. I think that we have shifted away from that toward a more of a fee-based judicial system. I'm not certain that it's an improvement. I think that our system should be more covered with tax dollars rather than fees, and particularly access fees for our people to get to court. We have seen sort of an inexorable shift away from general fund revenue to a fee-based thing, and this happened actually when we were flush with money. It did. And as you know, I voted for this tax, a $40 million tax, and as you know, that's really out of character for me. But in the last session, it became clear to me that the only alternative was the evisceration of the judicial system. And so I would hope that this panel recognizes that what we're doing with fees and taxes should be a Band-Aid. It should be a short-term fix, and that we don't try to establish these taxes on access to judicial review and fees on access to judicial review as the norm, because I think that's wrong.
Okay. Representative Ben?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The opportunity here is great, and based on almost 33 years of legal experience, I can say that these challenges of redoing the system are complex. And it's been interesting since I started practice back in 1977 to watch the refinement of our rights translate into a greater need for more professional help for folks. And it's also been interesting to watch in my part of the world, which is the southeast part of Oregon, and many people very, very poor, how difficult it is for many to put together the filing fees and put together the money that's necessary for, let's say, bail. And these issues are extremely important. So I kind of agree with Senator Whitsitt in his remarks about the general fund and the need for this element of our state to be adequately funded. It's amazing how little attention our legal system receives in light of how important it is. So the challenge, of course, is this is a detailed, complex work, and looking at how it's been cobbled together and trying to figure out how to make it better is going to be interesting. So I look forward to the opportunity to serve, and I'm very happy to be on the committee.
And we're happy to have you here as well. Representative Garrett.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I agree wholeheartedly with what Representative Bentz has said. And I don't know if this is a time to pose a question about how broad our mandate is on this committee. But the issue that we're looking at, the fee structure and revenue structure for the Judicial Department, is closely related to another issue, perhaps is inextricably linked to that issue, which is how we fund court facilities around the state. And a lot of work was done in the past interim on that. And I don't know how our mission on this committee is going to relate or not to that work, but that is certainly something we need to be cognizant of going forward.
Good comments.
Thank you.
Mr. Bray.
Thank you, Senator Verger. I'm looking forward very much to working with the members of the committee on this issue. As a representative for the Oregon Judicial Department, I hope I'll be able to bring some insight and understanding of in fact, how we did get to this present situation, which I think has been fairly well described. And it is an honor for me to be here.
That's the balance that we need. Mr. Kent.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. From the bar's perspective, I'm here to be an asset for the committee members, give you my perspective, offer you some information, substantive and maybe anecdotal as well. And our concerns are like everybody else's concerns, are balancing the access to justice issue and the stabilization of the judicial revenues. And our system is candidly stretched, some would say in various parts almost breaking. And I'm here to help. So
good.
I look forward to working.
Good. Welcome. All right. On our agenda, we are going to review the charter and our goals. And with us today, we have two very experienced people to help walk us through this, John Borden and Robin Lamont from LFO. Welcome to both of you. You're going first, John?
Co-Chair Verger and Co-Chair Nathanson, we have put together a charter for the interim committee, and in general, it falls in two parts. The first part will be to develop a recommendation for the allocation of revenue that was generated by House Bill 2287 for the upcoming 2010 special legislative session. The second part will be more of the meat and potatoes of the committee after the 2010 session, where there will be an in-depth evaluation of the overall structure of the Judicial Department's revenue and how that can be better economized and looked at for to address some of the current concerns that committee members have talked about this morning. So overall, those are the two broad mandates. The second mandate will be it will also include a state-to-state comparison, a best practices look, look at other things that may augment the revenue issues, such as collections and so on. Next, we go to the principles of the committee, and the principles are access to justice, a revenue system that is easily understood and transparent, a stable source of funding for the justice system, a systematic approach to the distribution of the revenue that's generated, the alignment of revenue that's collected with its use, and an attempt to minimize the administrative costs of any system that's developed. On the back of the charter are decision-making parameters. These parameters include looking at all the revenues of the department, including those that are statutory and administrative in nature. The interim committee's recommendation to the 2011 legislative session will reflect a long-term or permanent funding solution. The approval of all fees, fines, costs, or surcharges should be statutory in nature and subject to legislative approval, which is what is required of the executive branch. The interim committee's recommendations should not negatively impact the state's general fund. The interim committee's recommendations, if they have an impact on local courts, then there should be an appropriate recommendation from the committee for legislation surrounding that. The revenue generated should be accounted for discreetly in statutorily established funds, and the recommendations related to revenue generation should be limited to the preservation of existing services and should not include new initiatives at this time. The rest of the charter is a meeting schedule, which the dates will be filled in, but in January, there'll be a discussion of the allocation for the current House Bill 2287 revenues. And then at the very beginning of the special session, it will be tentatively the committee's approval of their recommendation. That recommendation will likely flow through the Joint Committee on Ways and Means as part of an omnibus budget bill. After the special session, there will be tentatively a May meeting, which will be court users and payers, and a state-to-state comparison. In around August, there will be a discussion of the proposal for new revenue and distribution structure. And then we'll likely have a meeting at the beginning of the 2011 regular session. And other meetings may be necessary, but that's a broad outline of meetings and agendas.
I have one question, John. over on the very beginning, the purpose now through February is to actually address the distribution of some of the revenues. So if that is done and we accomplish this before our special session, then does that not hold for the distribution that would come later? In other words, is this going to be the same, or are we going to elaborate on that distribution as we go forward?
Co-Chair Berger and Co-Chair Nathanson, they will be different. The House Bill 2287 revenue is temporary, one-time in nature, and that allocation and the specific parties, the specific entities that are involved in that allocation tentatively at this point, and that were included in some end-of-session measure, will be likely addressed at that during the special session. And then any new structure that the committee develops or recommends may require a wholly different distribution.
I just wanted to get that on the record so that whatever we do in the beginning is totally different than what might be at the end of the day.
Yes.
For the 2011 session. I also want to welcome Aaron Seiler. We are very, very happy to have always on these committees our administrative assistants. They are valuable, valuable people. And I don't think we could ever get along without them. And so, Aaron, welcome to you, and we look forward to working with you. And would you like to make any comments?
I would just like to also introduce Mike Riley, who he and I work together in committee services, and he's a great assistance to us and our committee, so I'd just like to introduce him also.
All right. Welcome, Mike. Nice to have both you and Aaron with us. And now we're going to find out a little bit about what has been done and how we got to where we are and with our fee structure and serving on that committee and doing some great work under some quick pressure was Representative Nathanson and Senator Walker. And so I'll ask you to both come to the dais and educate us.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Are you a co-chair? Yes, you are. I love that. Working together, both chambers. Vicki Walker, a former state senator, former chair of the Board of Parole, currently administrator for the Board of Parole. I'm a lot of formers, but I'm still quite here and ready and able and willing to do my task before you today. I need to make a statement because there's a little statute we passed in 05, I think, about a legislative cooling off period. Actually, it might have been 07. So I am here at your request. I am here not to lobby you. I am here to provide you information because Representative Nathanson and I co-chair the work group that set the fees in motion. And I am here not to give you my opinion. Now, I've never been short on giving my opinion, but today I will be. So please don't ask me for my opinion because I just can't do that. I can give you an interpretation about the work that we did, but I will not be providing you with any guidance about how you are to proceed today because that has been given to you in your charter from our capable LFO staff. So with that statement, I'd like to just sort of go into the background, if I might.
Sure.
Thank you very much. I do want to tell you how much I appreciate Mr. Borden and Ms. Lamont. They were thrown into this with Representative Nathanson and I, and we were given 2 days to accomplish our task. We ended up taking three. I never follow the rules, but we needed three because there was a lot of work to be done, and the first day was sort of getting a grip on how we were going to move forward. I do have my bill file and all of my notes in front of me so that should assist us today. We had a charter then, as you do now, in terms of what we were asked to accomplish by the big chief co-chairs, as I call them, Representative Buckley and then Senator Carter. We were asked to generate the fees that would provide the deficit the court was facing. We were asked to provide a couple of different, we had a couple of different alternatives that we were to look at to raise approximately $39 million in a very short period of time. The work group assembled and we had guiding principles that we were to preserve the access to the courts, which was fundamental and which has been mentioned here today. We needed to provide legislative oversight of its fiduciary responsibilities, transparency in the collection and distribution of revenue, systemic public safety approach to the distribution of funds, alignment between payers and the purpose for which the funds are distributed, and practical implementation to minimize administrative costs. And the surcharge would be over a two-year period. Now, surcharges are not unusual to the Oregon court system. We've actually been operating with them since 2003 when Oregon faced a fiscal crisis at that time, as we faced in the 2009 session. So you saw bills every session that would just roll over the temporary surcharges because they were always temporary. In this case, the temporary surcharges that were in existence would not get us to our ultimate goal of approximately $39 million, so we had to implement new surcharges. There was a diverse group of folks invited into the work group. We had representation from the criminal defense lawyers, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, district attorneys, Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, private collectors, Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Judicial Department, and of course our legislative support staff, and Representative Nathanson and myself. It was a really interesting discussion. We were able to get through it very quickly because our charge was to get through it quickly. But I went into the work group knowing that we had to come out of it with the money in our hand, so to speak, and we also had to come out of it with the creation of this committee that you now serve on. I actually refused to head up that work group unless the ultimate goal was to set up an interim committee that would look at the judicial system and how it's funded and how we can continue to provide access to justice. It was very important to me, and it was very important to all of the members of the work group. So we had a list of fees that had come to us from the department, the judicial department. We had a list of fees that came to us from some of the participants in the work group, and we reviewed those. We went through them. We had a list on the board. We had a computer at hand. Mr. Borden would put it up on the screen, and we would say, okay, let's increase this fee by $10. How much does that raise? And he'd put it in his little computer program, and poof, it would show us on the screen how much money it would generate. And so we went through that whole list, and then as we were going through the list, we would determine whether this fee would be too difficult to collect, too complicated, too much of a burden on the folks who use the system, or any number of things. And so everyone around the room had an opportunity to discuss that. And it was really, we were cheering ourselves on to the goal line. It was much like moving the football down the field every 10 yards, because we had to get to that amount. And $39 million was a lot of money. So as we went through it, we decided what we could live with and what we could not, and I think we were quite pleased with the outcome.
I will tell you that as we finished up, the justice courts and the municipal courts sort of got very excited and concerned, because the way the bill was written or would be written would force them to pay their fee increases to the state into this separate account, and they were just going ballistic about that because they need money to operate their courts as well. So sprinkled throughout the bill that you see, House Bill 2287, I went through it early this morning because I couldn't sleep, which is not unusual. And there are several locations throughout the bill where it indicates that a surcharge imposed by a county court under this section or by a justice court under this section shall be paid to the county treasurer. So that you will see sprinkled throughout the bill. It's also at the very front. And so we made sure that we would preserve the rights of the local justice courts to retain their funds. I don't believe we ended up getting $39 million. We ended up, actually we did. We got to 39.5. We needed a cushion because we did not think that we would be able to collect all of these fees. So we had a little bit of a cushion, and we also released some money, a provision to release the money quickly, a certain amount before we get to the February special session, because the courts needed money to operate. So that's sort of how we got to where we are. That's why we're here in front of you with this interim committee today. And I will indicate that I have my notes from the committee meeting, the subcommittee meeting on which I served and you co-chaired, Senator, from June 18th, 2009. And my the question was asked by Senator Whitsitt of Mr. Hendricks about this requires a 3/5 vote, so it must be a tax. We can't have an e-clause on a tax. The answer back was the Constitution uses different terms. The 3/5 vote is needed to raise revenue. The e-clause only applies to bills that regulate taxation. If we have opined wrong, then the e-clause would fall off the bill and the surcharges after October 1 would fall off the bill. So that was the answer on the record, as well as I could have written it down at the time, and Mr. Hendricks is here to tell you if I've not interpreted that correctly. So I'm glad I keep all my bill files, because I find that I need them for situations like this where we can talk about the work that we did. So I think that covers my presentation, and I'd like to turn it over to Representative Nathanson to fill in the gaps.
I have one question before you turn it over, and one comment. My comment is that unless people have worked with the former senator, they have no idea of her copious notes, which includes telephone conversations. So if you call her, there is a notation of the date you called her, the time, and what you said. So I'm sure as she goes on into other jobs, have that fair warning that she has everything on record. And we, at times like this, how much that is appreciated. My question to you that you did not mention in your kind of your when you were analyzing the fees, you did not mention court duties or jobs that you were performing or the people were performing throughout the court system that actually were oversights and had never been charged for, but yet were requiring staff work and etc. Was that part of this conversation at all?
No.
In other words, if you had, did you look at the system where there was things that had never had fees attached to them, but actually in reality should have been charged because there was an impact to those that were doing the work?
Madam Co-Chair, that is an excellent question, and yes, we did review that matter. For instance, bench probation. There was never a charge for bench probation, which is given at the local court, because bench probation is available because we have a shortage of parole and probation officers, or at least they have a big caseload, and I know that now quite personally at my own job now. And so the courts will sometimes impose bench probation and monitor the offender. There never was a fee before for that. Now there's a $100 fee, which the work group felt was appropriate because it required court time. There were other things, other fees that we impose, and Representative Nathanson has the list, and I'll let her speak to that even more, and I've got the list here as well. Yes, we did review that matter, and we're trying to make sure, the committee was trying to make sure that the court system recovered its costs, because it felt it felt that it could not do this work for free, because as Senator Whitson has opined, it is not supported by taxes, it's supported by fees. And so the court is sort of limited in the money it had to work with. There are some other funds that come into the court, but by and large, over the years, because of the way our budgeting has worked, the fees have become the primary source of revenue for the courts. So yes, we did review that matter, and I'll let Representative Nathanson expand.
Thank you very much. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. First, I'll start with the issue of new fees. I have a list. Now, this list is dated May 20th, and there were probably three or four iterations of that list during the day into the evening, and then there was another list after that. But as of this time on May 20th, in the category of new civil fees, we were looking at satisfaction of judgments, court monitoring, that was the bench probation, an annual accounting fee on probate that was considered in steps, where if the value of that account was not more than $500,000, the fee would be 100, for example. Something more than $500,000, the fee would go up. Probation violation assessment, an ex parte fee on defendant, expungement, a fee for expungement, for example. So there was a list. You have just heard an excellent overview of what happened over that three-day period. I would like to add just a few comments on how I viewed the work that happened. First of all, the group around the table was extremely cooperative and collaborative in trying to figure out how to raise that amount of money quickly. However, I want to underscore that everyone at the table acknowledged that there were some things that we did that maybe it wasn't the ideal answer. It was what we could do in that amount of time in basically an emergency situation. This is what people agreed they could live with as a temporary fix, understanding that a committee such as this would be coming together during the interim to review the whole thing and talk about it in not only in depth but in the context of the whole system of collecting fees and types of fees. So I want to underscore that yes, everyone agreed it was cooperative, but it was known this is what we can live with for this time period. The second thing I want to mention also related to that is when we would ask questions about, do you think you'll collect about 90%, 80%? How many of these kinds of cases do you think you'll have? Again, because we were working on a very quick basis, we used a lot of best guess. It was known that we were dealing with ballpark estimates and best guesses. I think we had excellent staff support from LFO, excellent support from the courts and from other people in sort of double-checking and offering best guesses and assumptions. But that was another key element. A second aspect that I wanted to discuss is we weren't really supposed to be reviewing what the money was spent on. We were trying to come up with money to spend on existing services. So we were talking about the money that was raised, but always on the side there is that idea of what the money is spent on. And there is a recognition that it's not just the courts, the activities that happen in the physical buildings of the courts. Court activities, in some cases, are not related to the specific physical site. There are also other types of programs or activities that are part of the justice system, but it's not part of the court per se. And I think everyone acknowledged that we need to keep that in mind as we move forward. We're funding a system, not just some physical court buildings. To sum up, I think I, because you received such a wonderful, thorough explanation, I think I will end with, in part, what Senator Walker started with, which is, what were we looking at? What was our task? We were looking at not only raising money to reach that target, but the ease and cost of collection and implementation. There were some things that we could have considered raising the fee or imposing a new fee, but it was unknown whether we'd even be able to collect it or what it would take court staff and then others to follow up on collecting the money. It just wasn't worth it. So we kicked it off the table. It may be back on the table in your discussion, but ease and cost of implementation was an important factor. We looked for a favorable comparison with other states. We had information in front of us about not only what we charged, but what was charged in other states for the same or similar kinds of fee. We looked at fairness to the payer, the ability to pay, as well as what it was for. Access to not only the court system, but access to justice in a more general and philosophical sense. And again, at that time, what we came up with is what would be feasible for temporary and immediate implementation. And this group that begins work today will be able to look more broadly and not be limited to just what was feasible for temporary and immediate implementation. That concludes my additional comments.
Any questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Quick question about ability to pay. I was curious, given the breadth of these increases, did you look at changing the existing rules for waivers of fees, or does this bill leave, did we leave all those intact?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Garrett, I was just about to fill in that blank because I realized both of us failed to address that. We did discuss the court's ability to waive fees. It did not change with these surcharges, so the court is still able to waive the fees in whole or in part based on ability to pay, and that was pretty critical to the group, which is why we had to have a cushion, because there may be more fees that needed to be waived. In addition, I would say there were some folks outside of the work group who got a little spun up that we were increasing violations by more of a surcharge. It's $45, and misdemeanors and felonies we increased by $35. Well, the reason for that is because violations include traffic violations, and that's where all the money is. So we had to keep it at 45. We originally had it at 45, and I remember specifically looking at it on the screen. I said, that's too much. We're going to have to bring that back down. So we brought it down, and then in the end, when we had this huge gap, we had to bring it back up to $45. So that was very much a part of the discussion, Representative.
Thank you.
And I have one additional comment. I can't recall what it was. There was, I believe, at least one instance where we lowered a fee and one fee that I believe we removed entirely.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Yes.
All right. Thank you both. Oh, Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I know in your 3 days that you didn't have much time for philosophical thought. You were busy. But It seems to me that there is a difference between charging a fee to someone who has been determined to be guilty of something and is under the supervision of the court or whatever. That is a cost recovery mechanism. But when we start charging fees for access to the court before the determination is made, that seems to me to be inappropriate. It's not, to me, it's not defensible to do that, because that's part of the what is should be provided by our system to the people, and as a result of paying taxes and so forth. But I don't think you should be charged a fee to get access to the court. But I don't have too much of a problem with someone who's been adjudicated and is under supervision or whatever of paying their way on that. And then the other thing is the and I don't know that you intended for this, but in 2287, we'll call it a tax, and you won't. But we applied a tax to access and to continuing management of cases and so forth, and then we used that money for something else. For instance, the 35% of it went to the public defense services. And so is it appropriate, in your mind, to tax the judicial system to support an entirely different agency?
Well, Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitson, you've now crossed into the territory of asking me for my opinion. And as I stated when I came here, I cannot give you my opinion. I can tell you what the work group discussed.
I could ask Representative Nathanson for
help. Representative Nathanson is not under the same constraints as I am. But the work group, we did have some philosophical discussions about that. And I think we had a charge in front of us to provide money to fund the system. At first, there was some discussion about where the money should go. District attorneys were included in the distribution, that we were going to fund them with this extra cash. And that was not our charge. And so the big chief co-chairs, ultimately in consultation with the co-chairs of the Public Safety Subcommittee, Senator Berger and then Representative Shields, amazing, all these people have changed jobs, but they both had that conversation with the co-chairs as well about how that would be distributed, and really they limited it to the courts and the public defense services because their budget was cut by about $13 million, if I recall correctly from my work on the subcommittee. It was quite a chunk of change. And so the co-chairs felt that we needed to fund that organization, that agency, and so we did, but the rest of it was left up for the February session for those folks to make that decision. And I think that pretty much covers my area of giving you the facts rather than my opinion. So I'll allow Representative Nathanson to articulate her opinion.
At this time, because we're in a discussion of what the previous work group did, I'm not going to take the time from the agenda right now because I want to be sensitive to what the co-chair might be feeling about managing our time. I'll be happy to discuss it because it will be part of our responsibility on this committee. But it was not something that we came to a conclusion, either a consensus or divided opinion, because it was determined it was just outside the purview of the work group that we were dealing with at that time.
I will also add, Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we would have never been able to complete our work in 3 days had we gotten into the details of determining who should get the money. So this allowed us to complete our work and move on with the session and what we were charged with.
Thank you. It's my understanding this committee has a year and a half, not 3 days. So maybe we can. Thank you.
I actually thought we did an excellent job in 3 days. We had Mr. Hendricks there as well to assist us, and I see he's in the room today. He's just a great asset to the Legislative Assembly and can provide you with a lot of historical knowledge and legal opinion. And, of course, you have your two excellent staff from LFO who were very important to us getting to the end goal.
Well, I appreciate both of you, appreciate the education that you've given us as a good basis for our discussion, and you've done a great lead-in, former Senator Walker, to asking Mr. Hendrickson, Mr. Hendricks to come to the dais because he is going to follow you.
All right. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here this morning.
Co-Chair Ruger, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name's Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council's office. I've been asked to come to kind of give you a big, wide-scale sort of synopsis of basically three things. One, which courts are we talking about here? Two, the civil side of the revenue collection process in the courts under the statutes. And then three, the criminal side of that picture, the revenue picture in the courts. And I only have about a half an hour, so I'll try to be as brief as I can. On the court side, the first thing we need to make sure we have clear in our minds is that we're talking about what is I refer to and is commonly referred to as the state courts. Now, the definition that I use of what is a state court as opposed to a local court is that a state court is a court that's paid for out of the general fund. Except for those amounts that have been raised by 2287, the money that's raised from fees and traffic citations and criminal fines, et cetera, under the code, historically have all gone into the general fund. And we're talking about those that are raised in the state courts. So when we look at this and we're talking about revenues and how to expend those revenues, we have to look at, well, which are those courts? Which courts do we fund out of the general fund? The big one are the circuit courts. Those are the courts of general jurisdiction. They are the courts where almost all cases start. If you're talking about your automobile collision case, your tort case, you're talking about your traffic citation, you're talking about your felony case, they are in circuit court where they are going to be tried. They are the ones that are the most where most of the money is spent, and it's where most of the money is raised. Beyond that, we have the appellate courts, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and finally the Oregon Tax Court. So those are the state courts. Those are the ones that we're looking at, the money that's being raised from these fees and the money where the money is going to be spent. That leaves the local courts. Who are the local courts? They're the justice courts, which are basically established by the county and whose revenues go to the county, and the municipal courts, established by cities and whose revenues go to the cities. There are also county courts in Eastern Oregon that have some judicial functions, probate and juvenile. They are a small piece of the picture, but are another one of the local courts that are out there, and you may, you know, can confuse things because they do come into play. Not to be confused with the circuit courts. These are actually the county courts. They are actually the legislative body, serve the function as the county commissioner in those counties as well. So just to make sure, in case that comes up later on, they're out there, probably not going to get discussed much. The justice courts and the municipal courts, while they are not, we're not talking here about raising revenues for them, at least we aren't at this point, raising revenue for them, and we certainly aren't worried about how they spend the money in those courts, do play a significant role when we start talking about the criminal side of this. And I'll bring those back up when we come back, because they play a big role in collecting revenue that eventually ends up in the general fund. And I'll talk a bit about later when we talk about how money comes in on the criminal side of the revenue equation for the courts. House Bill 2287 really did very little, had very little effect with respect to revenue in the local courts at all on the civil side of the question, on civil cases. There was nothing in there that was significant there. Where it was significant with respect to the offense surcharge, which I'll talk about in a bit, the amounts that's being tacked onto fines, and also in those areas that are related to criminal proceedings, those other fees, things like diversion and et cetera, where monies that, where they do the same sort of thing in justice courts and municipal court, put someone on probation or sign a diversion agreement and charge a fee, those, we split out those revenues from those, and those would are going to the counties under 2287. So that's the big picture. You know, we've got the state courts, we've got the local courts. I believe, you know, the principal focus, obvious of this group is looking at the state courts because we're looking at general fund revenues, how they're raised, and how they're expended. So, turning to the civil side of the picture, looking at the revenues that come in from court filings, from civil cases, I was asked to kind of take a look back over the last 20 years and say, well, what's happened here? Kind of how did we get here? You remember Douglas Bray knows a lot about this, and I've asked him to correct me if I misstate anything as I go through here, because he was part of the discussions over the years on a lot of these bills that came through, which dealt with fee changes over the years. And what I did was I started back and I took a look at starting in 1989. That was my first session here. So for me, it was kind of a logical place to go back 20 years and say, okay, what was the situation on the ground then? At that point, we had most of the what I call the base filing fees, the ones that are out there like, well, how much is the base fee for filing a divorce case? What's the base fee for filing a forcible entry and detainer action by a landlord? What's the base fee for getting a change of name? Most of those were on the book at that time. For instance, the general filing fee for filing your torts claim, your tort case in circuit court would have been $65 for the plaintiff and $32.50 for the defendant when they filed their response. At that time, we had a conciliation and mediation fee on the books. That was set by the county, and it was only in those counties that offered those services, and it was only charged in domestic relation cases. We had a dispute resolution surcharge. That was $5 and was also only in domestic relation cases. We had a law library fee that could not exceed 40% of the filing of the base filing fees, so 40% of $65 would have been tacked on in those counties that had law libraries. And finally, we had a legal aid fee, $22, that was added on all civil filing fees to support legal aid services in the county. And that, I believe, also was limited to those counties that provided those services. I'm not sure all counties had legal aid services. I'm not sure they still do. This didn't change very much, frankly, until 2003, when I went back and took a look at what had happened in each session as it went along. There were small tweaks over the years. In 1995, there was a $45 fee for filing a motion to modify your divorce decree. That was justified and justifiable, I think, based on the fact that those are almost like brand new cases where someone comes in after the final decree's been entered in the case and they want to make an argument for modification. It basically starts up a whole new proceeding. So in 1995, they said, well, rather than having that covered by that same base fee that you paid back when you first came in and those fees, we're going to have an additional fee when you start the whole thing up again after the case is over. So they added that in 1995. There were some increases in 1997 where the general filing fee, for instance, in a civil case went up to 97 and 73. By the way, in 1989, the base filing fee in your average vanilla case was $65 for the plaintiff and $32.50 for the defendant. Today, it's $107 for both the plaintiff and the defendant. So those numbers haven't changed that much when you look at them in the last 20 years. The difference that's happened from 2003, which I'm not going to talk, was as we ran into the budget problems starting in 2001. You remember, it was hard. We had five special sessions in 2002 to address the budget. They did not do that much with respect to court costs or court fees during those special sessions or during the 2001 session. But in 2003, they came back and said, we need to do something. The courts, you know, we need to raise money for the courts. The revenues aren't there to fund the thing. And that's when the first set of surcharges were brought in on civil filing fees. And what those were essentially usually a percentage amount that was temporary. That's kind of how we define surcharges on each of those base amounts. So you would look at the, at that time it was like $97 for the base filing fee, and they would say, well, we're going to have to charge another a 10% surcharge equal to $10 for the next 2 years to generate money to help fund the courts. And, you know, 2003, it was started on September 1st, 2003, and was scheduled to end on July 1st, 2005. And of course, there were lots of other things done at that time as well, as they were looking to raise revenues. The legal aid fee was increased. Legal aid. So they also did a general increase in fine amount for tickets to raise money towards help funding the courts, and you know, a couple of other small changes as well to try to raise revenue. But the surcharges were the main thing that they did at that point. They're saying for the next 2 years we're going to collect these additional amounts. To cut to the chase here a bit, and as former Senator Walker indicated, those surcharges have come back now every session. They have not gone away. They've been reenacted each session since, as the problem has continued. They've changed. They haven't stayed the same. In 2005, they set up a structure whereby some of the surcharge was added into the base amount and made permanent, but the surcharge still continued on for two more years. In 2007, they continued those surcharges, but they also did some additional changes. They added respondent. They made all the respondent fees. They used to be a differential between what the plaintiff paid and the defendant paid. They made those even so that everybody, the plaintiff and the defendant, paid the same fees. Legal aid fees were increased in 2007. And for the first time, we had a general fee on motions where the Chief Justice was authorized to impose a fee of up to $50 on motions that were filed by parties. I remember before, back in 1995, we'd authorized a fee for motions to modify a decree. This would extend to all motions filed by parties in a case. And then we get to 2009 with 2287. Once again, the surcharges were essentially continued up until June 30th, 2011, under the provision of 2287. We had the new fees that Co-Chair Nathanson had mentioned to you. All of those are temporary fees. They're all scheduled to go away under the bill on June 30th, 2011. So we have several things in there that look like fees that are there forever, but they're not. If you look on, you see they're all repealed on June 30th, 2011. And we did something in 2287 that was new, which we had not done before, which is we put a surcharge on criminal proceedings where a fine was imposed. It's called the offense surcharge in the bill. And I'll talk about that here as we get into the criminal side of it. So the big picture here is, you know, since 2003, we have been doing various sort of temporary provisions to get through the biennium, only to find at the end of the biennium that there was still a problem and needed to progress on. 2287, when you look at it, is sort of the one where it really opened up, where we had literally, you know, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 new fees, temporary fees, on things we had not had fees on before. Fees for asking for a settlement conference, for asking for a continuance on appeal, filing at bringing things to the court to sign, like an ex parte, not a motion, but a, something where you're just asking for a signature, for instance, on the judgment, where you would be needing to pay a fee. We have had filing fees that would increase based on how much you were asking for in the complaint. So if you're asking for more, you'd be paying a higher fee. So these are all new, they're all temporary, but these are what the work group was finding, and each of them, of course, had a revenue number attached to them for purposes of the work group's effort to try to find the revenue that they were being asked to find for the purposes of getting the courts through this biennium. 2287 set up a special account just for the amounts raised by the surcharge and these additional new fees. And all that money will be flowing into that account, and that's the money that you're looking at with respect to making decisions on in February, initial decisions for at least the amounts that are available at that point. And I'd be happy to stop there and ask if anybody has any questions on anything I've said so far.
Any questions so far? Representative Nathanson.
I'd like you to explain to us and remind me, there was a discussion in that work group during the session, either you or one of our LFO analysts. There were two things we heard about. One was acknowledging that the courts were being used and judges' time was being used for a hearing on something. And in trying to figure out what's fair, I think I recall that it was the same fee whether you were going to use the court for 2 hours or a whole day or 2 days, and that there really should be a difference. So that was one of the things. And the other was there was some discussion about what appeared to be a lack of recognition of complexity of cases, like how many people had joined in something, and that did take more work and more effort to manage, but there didn't seem to be a fee structure to acknowledge that some things were simple and some things were more complex. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Verger, members of the committee. Yeah, the problem with trying to fit the cost, the fee that's being paid by the party coming forward with the services being granted is an old problem, because it's sort of like how long is a piece of string. There are some cases where you are filing where literally the court, the only thing the court's being asked to do is basically a little bit of clerk's time to deal with the matter. For instance, a default divorce where someone is coming and just filing, they've already worked everything out, they've got it, all they're doing is filing, but you're still going to pay the filing fee. There's not a lot of work in that case. On the other hand, if you have a divorce come in, contested, children, support, large property holdings that have to be decided, 3-day trial, you know, the amount of work that can be required of the court, including the judge, can be phenomenal. And so you have that disparity, yet the fees that are being paid are essentially the same, except for some of these newer fees that have come along, such as the motion fee, which really does more or less try to tie it down more specifically to what it is that the parties are asking. I mean, if you don't pay if you don't file a lot of motions, you know, you don't pay a lot of fees. If you're doing a lot of motion practice, you're going to be paying more fees. So that is a difficulty in looking at trying to say, gee, people should pay based on the services that they receive. My impression over the years has always been that most people paying, if you looked at funding the system and saying people should pay what it takes to fund the system, nobody's ever going to pay enough in fees in order to fund what it is they get out of it. Most people would not be paying enough to get back what they're getting out of the system. I mean, when you think about, even if you're paying $2,000 in fees through the course of the proceeding, if you look at, you know, getting a jury trial, for instance, in circuit court, the cost to the system is obviously usually going to be greater than any amount of fee you can pay. And it's probably not even a great way to phrase it, because, you know, there's also the question is you do need to have a justice system. It's not as though if you don't want to get a divorce in court, you can go somewhere else. You know, they're a monopoly for these services, and there's always been, as I said, it has always been general fund paid for, not regarded as a fee paid for system.
One brief follow-up then,
Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I recall the Chief Justice making remarks in one of his, probably in one of his annual State of the Court addresses, as the court system becomes more clogged, as access becomes more difficult, individuals or businesses could start turning to other means to resolve problems. And that's something that I hope the group can spend a few minutes discussing. Are we trying to encourage people to use our public system, which ensures justice for everyone on an equal basis, or is there something we're doing, either intentionally or unintentionally, to say, oh, we're too busy, go figure it out yourself somewhere else?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Verger, members of the committee, I think that's true. I mean, there's, for at least commercial-type disputes and others, there's the arbitration is out there as an option if you want to go that route, if the parties are willing to agree to it. Unless you have a contract in advance, usually from, for instance, a consumer's point of view, arbitration may not be the ideal, though, since there are many of the aspects of arbitration that may not be, you know, starting with that there's no appeal, usually from a binding arbitration, that may not be particularly attractive. And so I think for most people, if they're offered the choice between the two, they would like to be in courts, but it is possible that the cost will get to the point where it becomes more attractive to go to arbitration.
I'm going to get you to proceed on the criminal. Our time is, the clock's running.
I will try to be as brief as I can.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Thank you.
First thing that's important to recognize with respect on the criminal side, when I say criminal, we're not just talking about things that involve jail time. We're talking about offenses, really. Offenses include felonies, misdemeanors, and violations. The difference between those being that felonies and misdemeanors can get you in jail, violations can only get you a fine. The revenues that are generated on the criminal side of the equation are mainly, I would say, probably traffic citations. It's where the money is on that side of the equation. Even though the fines are much bigger for felonies and misdemeanors, the collection problems with respect to situations in which you have jail, et cetera, that it gets much harder to collect, as opposed to the traffic citation, which the average citizen getting is going to see the number at the bottom of the ticket and send the money in, because it's so much easier than showing up at the appearance at the time that your alternatives show up. And so those traffic tickets drive a lot of the revenue stream on the criminal side. The problem in the past that the legislature had struggled with was that the money coming in from criminal citations go in lots of different places. There's four categories of places in the statute that says where the money goes. The first one's compensatory fines, which are pretty rare, so you don't need to worry much about those. But the second one is restitution. And that means this is a priority list. So that means that for a criminal judgment, when it goes out, the first thing that's going to get paid off is any restitution that's awarded under the judgment. That being the case, if you have a payment come in on one of those judgments, it may be a long time, if ever, that the state collects on the fine amount that's included as well. The third category includes the fine amount in the unitary assessment, which we'll talk about briefly. And then the fourth category is basically everything else, including county assessments and other things that are imposed on criminal offenses. When a ticket is issued and a payment comes in, again, if a person just pays the full amount of the ticket, that's pretty straightforward because the statute says, okay, you send them here, 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 and here. The problem that the legislature struggled with was when a payment came in, but it wasn't the full amount, because there was the problem, who gets paid first? And what the statute now does is basically lay out the categories and say, you pay this first, you pay this next, you pay this next. And as I said, restitution's first, then the fines and unitary assessments. The distribution of where that money goes gets even a little more complicated when you start looking at the statute. But the bottom line is, on most fines that are issued of the fine amount, the unitary assessment gets and the fines both get into what's called the criminal fine assessment account, the CFAA, and you're going to hear a lot about this as we go through. All of those amounts that get collected go into that account. And not all fines. I should say that right off the bat. I should say part of the fine, all of the unitary assessment go into the CFAA. And then the statute lays out a list of priorities that the legislature is supposed to look at in distributing those amounts. And those are folks who used to, and you look at that list, those are folks who used to get an automatic share percentage of the amount that was collected in that account. Now it's a prioritization, and there's a bill every session that basically allots out to those people different percentages, usually following the statutory priorities. Whatever's left after they make those allotments go into the general fund. It's a very complicated structure, and I was hoping to do a flow chart, and I'm hoping before we get to talking about changes to the system as opposed to, you know, these initial decisions on what to do in February, that perhaps I can get you one so you can kind of follow this through, because it is complicated.
Mr. Hendricks, I think that would be very helpful.
It's a complicated thing. I wanted to do it for this meeting and wasn't able to get time to do it, but I would like to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. The tickets are particularly complicated by the local courts, which I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. because local courts, when you look at the jurisdiction, what it is that justice courts and municipal courts can handle, in essence, mostly what they handle is traffic tickets and other things that are cited. You know, it's expensive to handle misdemeanors, and they don't have authority to cover felonies. So I don't think you'll go to an average justice court and find many misdemeanors going on, simply because they require appointed counsel and all sorts of other things that cost a lot of money. So they tend to do, the violation tickets. And when they get a ticket in, again, this is not a simple system, and it would take a lot longer than I'd ever have today to explain it all. But in essence, what happens is half of every fine that's imposed under a ticket is going to go into the CFAA, into the criminal fines and assessment account. The other half, where it goes, depends on who it is that wrote the ticket, which may seem strange, but that's where it works out. If a state police officer wrote the ticket, it doesn't make any difference where they send it. It's going to end up in the CFA and go to the state in one form or, you know, one of these under that distribution schedule that I earlier discussed. If a sheriff writes the ticket and sends it to a justice court, one half of it will stay with the county. And the same with a city policeman writing to the municipal court. And if no matter who sends it to the circuit court, it all goes to the state. So how much money comes out of any given ticket depends a lot on A, who wrote the ticket, B, which court did it get sent to. And that's the only thing I want to tell you about that at this point. If you get down into the mechanics of how the number gets on the ticket and all of that, that's a whole another layer of complexity about how those numbers change. But I will tell you that for increasing revenues with respect to violations, and violations again are the big ones as far as generating revenue, there are about four different ways that I can tell you that have been used in the past to change those revenues. One is to simply go in and increase the fine amounts. You know, there's a schedule of fines that is laid out for felonies, misdemeanors, and violations. And the last time we did it, I think, was in 2003. They went in, they upped the amounts. Okay, that increases revenues to the general fund. It also increases revenues to cities and counties because they have half of the amount that's coming in from those fines would end up going to them. And that's one way to generate revenue from looking at the criminal side of the equation. The second one is to increase minimum fine amounts. I mean, if you go in and tell the court you have to collect at least this percentage, and we have those statutes now on the books that say you have to collect at least as much, you cannot waive below this amount. There's another, you know, that's what a minimum fine amount is. The court is not authorized to waive below that amount. If you up that minimum, there's going to be more revenue coming in. You can increase the unitary assessment, which is the additional amount that's tacked on every offense. And as I mentioned before, all goes to the general fund because it all goes into the criminal fines and assessments account. And then finally, you can tinker with the ticket and the amount that shows up on the face of it, the so-called base amount, fine amount that appears on each ticket. Because if you tinker that, that's the amount that people send in. And that has a huge effect on the overall amounts that tend to get collected. So I'd be happy to talk with any of you individually when you have a chance, if you want to discuss it further about how this all works. I will try to get you a flow chart eventually on the criminal end of it so you have a clear picture on how all this stuff flows. It's a complicated structure. Simplifying it could be difficult. I should tell you, in 1999, we rewrote all of the violation statutes, and I was the drafter on that bill. Our charge at that time was not to make it simpler or to fix it. Our charge was to get onto paper what was happening out in the real world, because the statutes were pretty much divorced from the reality of what was happening on the ground. And so basically the statutes, as you now see them on violations and tickets, et cetera, merely reflect what the situation in 1999 is about, how they did things. Whether you want to keep doing it that way or not, that's another question, but it basically reflects what we were told by everybody involved, and we have not been asked to change it, so I assume we got it right.
I guess one of the important things, and I'm going to have to ask us to move on because of time, but one of the important things is that we must some people at the dais are going to understand this perfectly, but we must all be able to understand exactly what the system is now in order to successfully change it. And so I think anything that you can do that will help us understand exactly where we are with great clarity, the better off that we will be. Thank you so very much for your testimony today. And now I'm going to call Sarah Gates, who's going to give us an overview of the Oregon Judicial Department and their revenue structure. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gates. I'm with the Judicial Department. I oversee the Business and Fiscal Services Division. My job here today is hopefully to shed some clarity. I'm also probably going to point out some of the complexity as a precursor to better helping you better understand the system. And if the staff can turn on the projector for me, that would be wonderful. I'm going to talk with you about two predominant issues today. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the court-ordered case-related financial obligations, the filing fees and the fines and assessments that Mr. Hendricks has already talked to you about. Then I'm going to touch briefly on the administrative revenues that are charged within the department as well. In order to talk about this, there's really three areas in which we interact with the revenues for the justice
system. Sarah, excuse me, do you have copies of this, or can you give us copies later?
As the committee staff has them in your binder.
Okay. Madam Co-Chairs, that is in your binder behind the October 2009. There should be color slides as Ms. Gates goes through the PowerPoint presentation.
Okay, thank you very much.
we have three ways in which we really interact with the system. First, we impose a fine or assessment at the end of a case, or we collect a filing fee. We actually then have to collect the revenue, and then we distribute the revenue. All of those are done within the department. I'm going to stay at a very high level initially, and then I will talk in more detail to make sure you understand the processes that we go through. Talk about civil cases first, and please do not hesitate to interrupt me, but I am cognizant of the time and our 11 o'clock deadline to get done, so I'm going to keep moving unless interrupted. Mr. Hendricks already talked to you about civil cases and the filing fees and the types of fees that are in existence. There's a couple of things I want to point out, though. One is that these are statutory. They are provided. They are related to getting a service from the court. You may have multiple fees or surcharges on a given filing. We do have the ability to waive and defer filing fees. Talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And the amounts collected are predominantly distributed to the general fund or other dedicated sources such as the law libraries, dispute resolution, or legal aid. You've heard a couple mentions of fee waivers and deferrals. I wanted to give you a brief view of how often we do waive and defer filing fees based on the income levels of those people seeking services from the court. Most of our fee waivers and deferrals occur in the domestic relations case type, but they are available across the civil area. So we see them in general civil, small claims, and probate as well. For context, in 2008, the 14% of the cases that we had a fee waiver on, that's 6,500 cases. We deferred fees in 2,500 cases just for domestic relations cases. In criminal cases, we're talking felony, misdemeanor, and violation. It's a little more complicated, but you've heard Mr. Hendricks talk about the fines and assessments and restitution and compensatory fines. When we deal with individuals who cannot pay immediately, we offer payment plans so that they can pay over time, and then we follow up with collection activities if necessary. Collection of revenues occurs after sentencing because these fines are imposed after you are found to be guilty. The money is distributed to the statutorily intended recipients, such as victims, counties, cities, the CFAA account, or the general fund. I'm going to talk more about the distribution later, so you'll get even more detail on that. Part of what's very important to understand when you're looking at the revenue structure for the courts is how long these fines and assessments and fees remain collectible and what their shelf life is, as you were, and those are called judgment remedies. These all remain collectible for 20 years. In the criminal arena, now 50 years if you have restitution in the case. A civil case will have a 10-year life and it can be extended once for an additional 10 years. So there's a very long lifespan in which we deal with a filing fee or a fine and where it goes and all of the pieces of the case. So I want to move now into the complexity because I think that's really important as you get into your conversations about can we simplify this, how do we make it more transparent, because it is very, very complicated. I've been in this job for almost 4 years now and I'm only just getting a decent understanding. I still am not an expert by any means. We have hundreds of fees. We have fines and assessments that are very, very complicated to calculate. They're all based in statute. And in your binder, if you go back into the reference materials, you're going to find copies of our fee schedule. It is 40, 50 pages thick, a half inch, and those show all of the fees for the civil cases. The fines, just for the violations, similarly thick. And there's a lot of if, ands, and if this, then that type of language in there. So I encourage you to take a look at it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going over page by page right now, but it's very, very complicated. And we provided a lot of background on that so that you could get a sense of it. We also have the complexity that at the local level, these can vary. local ordinances can impact what is a Class A misdemeanor in this county and where that money goes and those sorts of things. And then on top of it, you can have multiple fines and assessments on a given case as well, depending on how many charges or what happens during the course of the case. And those can all go to multiple recipients. We have 185 local entities that we send money to on an ongoing basis every month. Those are city and county recipients. State recipients include the Department of Revenue, who distributes the CFAA and now the Stabilization Fund from the 2287 revenues, the General Fund, multiple state agencies. We send legal aid money to the Oregon State Bar. We retain some money to fund programs internally to the department, predominantly for the collections activities in which we undertake, but also to fund state court security and appellate mediation. 14,000 restitution checks are cut every month, and the distributions are made in that of revenues are made in the statutorily laid out manner in which Mr. Hendricks explained a few minutes ago. So you take $100 in, $15 will go here, $5 will go to another place, and you will have multiple checks, as it were, being sent out for every time we collect a payment. We do aggregate them before we send the checks, typically, though. So I want to give you two examples that maybe will make it moderately clearer as to why this is so complicated. The first one is a dispute, a domestic dissolution filing. So if you want to get a divorce, you walk into the court and you'll need to hand over a check for $181. And this is the average statewide amount. It does not include any local elements. The base fee is $99. It goes to the general fund. $5 goes to the surcharge account. Legal aid and law library get a component. We then have a dispute resolution, which goes to the general fund. DHS gets money, as does the higher education for domestic violence. So we have to then collect that money and then have it sent out electronically to all of these recipients. And all of these are statutorily set, and we have to make sure that there are no that everything's correct before we put these fee schedules up. On the criminal side, it's even more complicated, as I've said multiple times, because the amounts are not always fixed. They can vary depending on what the judge decides in the case. Is there restitution ordered? Well, if so, that amount depends on how much the damages are, and that will go to the victim as it's collected. What is the fine amount? It depends on what type of crime they've committed, how serious it was. That will go to the criminal fines and assessment account. The unitary assessment will also be imposed, and that will go off to the criminal fines and assessment account. We then have a county assessment, which is paid to the counties for various things. It also includes state court security money. And then if they don't pay us immediately, there's two things that get added onto the case. If it's not paid in full in 30 days, there's something called a payment schedule assessment that gets put on, and that has a tiered level, and it's been split between the general fund and the stabilization account with 2287. And then if we need to send it out to third-party collections, we have a 15% assessment that goes on that we pass through to our vendors, and it's really that covers our costs of using the vendors to collect what is owed. So as you can see, there's a lot going on in the courts when it deals with revenue. We just rolled out the new fee schedule yesterday for House Bill 2287 for the majority of the changes that took place. Indicative of the complexity of this system, I want to spend just a minute telling you what we had to do in order to put this into place, because one of the goals that was laid out in your charter is the administrative costs and how do we make this easier to do. So since the legislature adjourned in July, or at the end of June, we've spent the last 3 months with staff lawyers reviewing the bill to make sure we've interpreted it accurately. We have had to develop all the new fee tables and the base fine schedule, which required numerous staff hours and multiple staff being involved. Our court financial system had to be reprogrammed to be able to handle the new fees and fines and changes that are in place. In some cases, we couldn't change it, and we have to do things manually. We have to manually add the offense surcharge because it will require too much system programming. We have to test those changes. We had to provide updated information to each court to post on their website so we could give notice. We had to communicate with our partners, the bar, and the public. We had to train the staff because when somebody walks in, the amount they have to pay is now changed, and it has changed in ways they've never had to deal with. And it's very, when you have multiple parties involved now, or the amount that you're filing for, the amount in controversy escalator, these are all new and different. We've had to provide tools for them to actually calculate the filing fee amount. The forms that are used in the court had to be updated. We had to then get this all in place so that it was ready to go yesterday. And in the process, we were also looking at, okay, so what didn't work in this bill? What are all the statutory changes or workarounds we're going to have to put in place until we can have further conversations with the legislature? In all, we've had at least two lawyers working on this, probably half their time, if not more, since end of July. I've had four or five of my staff full-time dedicated for the last 2 months. We've had IT staff dedicated, plus multiple other people involved in a variety of ways. It takes a lot of resources to do this. Are there any questions about this part of the complexity before I move into giving you a perspective on how much money we're talking about and where it goes?
Proceed.
I've done my job. I've confused you completely. Okay. I want to take the next part of my presentation to help you understand how much money we're talking about and how much goes where. To get a context, I wanted to show you the caseloads that go through the court system on a given year. On average, about 800,000 cases. That includes a little over 200,000 parking tickets that go through Mr. Bray's court every year. Those are for the Portland parking. We have almost an equivalent number of violations that go through. The remaining are the other criminal cases and civil. In 2008, this is how much money we imposed, $215 million. And the majority of that was for the criminal area. We had about $30 million in civil, the rest, and about $3 million in juvenile, and the rest is criminal. And you can see how that splits out, about $70 million each for violation and felony, and $40 million for misdemeanor. The more interesting piece is then how much did we collect in that same time period? We collected $134 million. Now, that tells you something about the relationship. It's not just as simple as how much money do you make from the fee, but then you have to collect it as well before you can distribute it and use it. What you can see from this graph is the civil, the $30 million I mentioned of civil, we got nearly all of that we imposed. When it gets to the criminal side, it's a lot harder. And you heard multiple mentions of that, both from the co-chairs of the original work group, as well as from Mr. Hendricks. For felony cases, it's the hardest to collect. Those are the people who are in prison, probably lower income. It's just really difficult. It gets easier and easier as you move through misdemeanor and violation. Violation, you've got a lot of traffic. People can pay, you know, their speeding ticket, and parking is included there as well, and that is relatively easy to collect. One important thing to note when you look at how much we collect in a year is this is money, especially in the criminal area, that could be 20 years old, on a case 20 years old, that we finally collected some money on. So it's not a complete apples-to-apples relationship, but it does give you a general sense. So if you look at this over time, you can, the blue bars show how much we've collected every year. The red bar is the restitution that's outstanding that we need to collect on cases from that year. And the green bar are all the other amounts of money that we need to collect from other years. And I'm not going to spend time talking about collection efforts. That's for a different day and a different discussion. But we do have over $1 billion that is still outstanding in these fines and assessments that are, and restitution that is payable. So, where does the money go? You've heard some talk about that there are many different statutory recipients of the revenues, and this pie chart shows you the large categories of where the revenue collected by the department goes. The general fund and CFAA are the largest recipients. The stabilization account, which is the 2287 revenues, is now following behind at about $40 million, a little less than $40 million for this biennium. Cities and counties get a large proportion, and we retain about $25 million to run our collections program. That covers the cost of the staff and the systems and the vendors to collect the amounts. In your binder behind the presentation slides, you will find a more detailed sheet that shows you dollars that are sent to all the recipients, so you can get more details if you're interested. So now that I've gone through the court-ordered obligations, I want to talk just briefly about administrative fee revenue. And these are amounts that are not case-related. We charge for copies of documents that when someone comes in and says, I'd like a copy of my file, or can I see this and that, we charge that money. It goes to the general fund. It's 25 cents a page. When a person gets forms from the court to do a domestic dissolution or something like that, we charge for the forms packet. That covers our cost of printing and creating those forms. That is retained internally and is a cost recovery. OGIN Online is the online access to our case register, our electronic case register. That is a fee-for-use arrangement, and the revenues are used to support that system and the OGIN system that we currently use. Publications, we publish the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals and tax court opinions and other documents and the court rules and things like that. Those are a subscription service where you can buy them one-off, similar to how you can buy the ORS books. We also certify shorthand reporters and we court interpreter licensing, and those funds are set and pay for the program as well.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'd like to flag something for a future discussion or for a response to the committee. Charging for copies and charging for publications, as we move toward e-court, as we move toward greater use of electronic subscriptions and electronic documents, will that revenue decrease? Will you still be charging for providing electronic copies? So I'd like to understand what you see the future is for electronic copies of documents and electronic subscriptions.
Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Nathanson, I can give you a very brief answer in the but
I don't think
also
we have time today.
If you'd like,
let's just do it later.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And that concludes my presentation. If there are no more further questions. One more thing.
Excuse me, Sarah.
I'm sorry. I have
trying
one more
to do,
thing I'm
trying to do.
Do
a sidebar here.
I just remembered, and Aaron was just giving me the look, that I have one more thing on the agenda that I'm supposed to do.
Okay.
Once again, for the record, Sarah Gates, I'm supposed to also spend just a brief second talking to you about the distribution of the 2287 revenues. And right behind your presentation, you have another sheet of paper that shows it's labeled Justice System Surcharge Account Revenues and Distribution for the 2009-11 Biennium. And this is a ongoing worksheet that you will receive each time we meet, and we will update it monthly every time we have a new distribution to help you track how much revenue has been received from the 2287 revenues, where it will be distributed, and how much is remaining for allocation when you have your conversation in January. To date, we only have 2 months of actual revenues to present to you. Those are through August, and those are shown at the very top line of the worksheet, and that's because the majority of the fees did not take effect until yesterday, and we will not have actual revenues on those till mid-November. To date, we've collected $110,000 from...
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt and just point out, I think what we're looking at is the back side of the page.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
And So the $110,000 to date has been transferred to Department of Revenue. They have not made any distributions yet according to the statutes, where 35% will go to the Public Defense Services and 65% will go to the Judicial Department, up to a total of $10 million. Those distributions will not be made until there's a balance of $500,000 in the account. So we're expecting the first distribution in the November timeframe.
Thank you very, very much, Sarah. That was good job.
I think I am now done.
I think you are now done, but you did a good job, and thank you for providing the visuals. I think that that's very, very good. We need that. Okay, committee, that completes our agenda except for our next steps, and we're going to be running right on time, I think. I've just been talking with Aaron, and actually Co-Chair Nathanson and I have not gotten together and gone over what we need to do because of just the busy schedule that we've had, but between now and our January meeting, I can assure you we will be doing that and planning how we're going to work this out. But for right now, we'll be getting additional background information. Is that it, Erin?
Well, co-chairs, I would like to know if there's any additional background that members feel they would like to see, if there's any requests from both LFO, administrative staff, Department of Justice, for materials that were, or questions that were raised today with materials.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
A question maybe to the Judicial Department. Is there going to be any mechanism to track the increase of all of these soft costs that they generally described as we go forward to implement this new fee structure?
Okay. You got that?
Yep.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Nathan.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. That sort of begs the question for me then. How this is related to the conversion to e-court, for example, will that make things simpler or more difficult? How will the timing of our decisions be folded into the development of e-court and programming? Is there something that that's on the horizon, already scheduled, already funded, that helps make all that terrible stuff you had to go through for this temporary system of fees and surcharges? Is there something that's going to make that easier that we should know about?
Well, there's a real need to collaborate there within the justice system, because we don't want to, at the end of the day, find out that we've done all the work, then now we've been a hindrance to the system. That would be very unfortunate. I also want to welcome Mr. Lehman from the Judicial Department. Welcome today.
You,
you're an administrative assistant, I believe.
I'm a legislative communications manager is my formal title.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for that correction. Are there any questions that anyone has on the committee? Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yes, if this is a true pay-as-you-go system, or if that's what we're doing, then I would be interested in knowing on these transfers out on this sheet of paper, our attention was just drawn toward how the general fund and these other numbers use those monies for court-related purposes, if at all. And if not, then I would like to know maybe the history on how it happens that revenues generated by our courts are being used for things other than courts.
Right.
And how to get there, it may be in this large notebook, and maybe not. But if we're going to be talking about the pay-as-you-go, we might as well see if we're doing it that way now.
Good question. Other questions? Okay, we need to talk about our next meeting date in January. And it actually might come, when does the session start?
Madam Co-Chairs, the special session in February will start the first week of February. We are concerned with the January meeting date that we hold it after the special election that is likely to occur on the 26th. So that's a Tuesday, the 26th. So we're looking at potentially meeting the 27th, 28th, or 29th, and then immediately meeting again after special session starts.
Okay.
When are the legislative days scheduled for January?
I just ask her that, and I'm sure that we will be coming after the 26th, but my understanding is we only have 5 days.
Correct.
Before the special session starts. So for those of us who are going to travel a distance, we don't want to get here and have to go back and then come back. I mean, 5 days is not very many. So, I mean, if we get here for the special session, I mean, we would want to just stay. If we get here for the committee, we would want to just be able to stay for the special session, is what I'm trying to say. So, Erin, what does that put the meeting?
The reason I asked about the legislative day, the committee days that are scheduled, is seems that we could take advantage of being in Salem for those days to discuss the rationale for the distribution of the fees. The amounts may be altered, or maybe even some of the distribution based on the outcome of an election, but we'll have to move so quickly, it seems like we would benefit from an hour or two conversation.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What day, do you know when the committees are going to be meeting in January?
No. Co-Chair Verger, I'm afraid I don't have the calendar in front of me. It's due.
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chairs, I think that maybe that is a good suggestion. I mean, when you look at how compressed the time frame is between the 26th and when the legislature starts, it may be having a discussion. I think there are pieces that are missing from today's presentation. For example, what is the general fund portion of the Judicial Department budget? What are the justice system entities that we are talking about? What are the criteria that you would want to apply? I mean, I think there are a number of things that you could look at. So it may be that staff needs to look at when the next scheduled legislative day is and consider then having that your second meeting around those days, but not finalize any recommendations until the first week, for example, of the legislative session.
So you're suggesting, and I think it's a good one, that we meet in the next before the holidays. Our next meeting and have those discussions. And so if we do that, then we can kind of firm up the January date and have it work out better. Well, let's work around when the committee days are, just as we've done this time, and just have the meeting. The second meeting will be probably on Friday if it works out the same. It'll be the Friday after the next group of committee meetings, and we'll go through what Ms. Lamont have suggested in the additional information.
Co-Chair Verger at Wendy Johnson Law Commission just passed me here a note that says that it looks like the 12th, 13th, and 14th of January will be the legislative days.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
There are November legislative days, and we originally had not discussed a November meeting date, but we certainly can put that onto our charter and work around those dates to address the questions raised and issues raised by Robin.
Well, I have a suggestion. If staff could find out if the members of this committee would be available for 1 hour at some point during the November days, we could catch up on the rest of the materials. That could be considered the briefing and background information that we didn't have time for today, and also reserve the potential for meeting during the January legislative days to talk about the kind of rationale we would want to use for distribution of fees, even though it won't be possible perhaps
that
to
would be
assign
13th, 14th,
a number,
or 15th.
At least get our conversation started about the rationale for how we would distribute it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You got that, Erin?
Yes, I do.
All right. Very
here
good.
Anyway, let's
Is there anything else to come before the committee? Yes, Representative Garrett.
Madam Co-Chair, I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but I've been made aware of a couple of concerns about existing House Bill 2287, and I wonder if part of our chore between now and February should be to take those into consideration for possible fixes. Has time been allocated to do that? We're talking about distribution of revenues, but I've been informed, for example, of concerns about the change to the pretrial release amount. I talked to the co-chair Nathanson about this, that some have suggested may even be vulnerable to a constitutional challenge, and I wonder if we need to set aside time to hear that issue.
I guess just a response without thinking too much about it would be, I think we should be very careful in how much in-depth we get in trying to change this temporary situation that they have worked out. I don't, in other words, you know, if you get into it, it's going to be, everybody is going to have some part of that 2287. I have my own things in 2287, so, you know, by magic, if you can change. So I guess I'm open to the discussion by other members as to what you think about that. I think that that's somewhat tempting sometimes when you get into those discussions, that there's no end of the, no control over the end of it. So what do you think, Representative Nathanson?
If there, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. If there were a way to limit the review to technical or legal problems with that bill, so the way the statute is now, I think it would be okay to do that, and we could forward those to the staff to take a look at and let us know, you know, what's within the purview of what might need to be fixed, but then honor the agreement that we've got a bunch of temporary things we put in place. They're going away anyway. We're starting the discussion fresh, not open it up, as you suggested we could. Everybody gets to then complain about their favorite problem.
That's right. I think that would be a mistake. But what do you think, Representative Kieran?
Well, I think that's absolutely an appropriate distinction. I'm not suggesting we would revisit all the policy choices that were made. But to the extent that some of these changes could, even as temporary changes, lead to a legal challenge and litigation, and if that litigation is successful, a reduction in the revenues that are projected on which we're basing our decision making, we may need to consider that.
I think Mr. Borden has something to add.
All right.
Co-chairs, a couple of things. The need for a technical fix has been brought to our attention and Legislative Council's attention, and we're aware of it. And also, as part of the normal process during the 2010 special session, will be a program change bill where technical or non-policy fixes can be addressed as part of the routine ways and means process. So we have that general issue flagged, but no specifics at this time.
Very good. You're always, as always, you're ahead of us. There you go. All right. If there's nothing else to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.